First case is 98780, Cincinnati Bar Association versus Terry Walsh.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, I'd like to apologize for my client having a present today. She's a young woman here, her first child, she's been here October, and she's practicing law for the last month or so. We filed these objections in this case. The procedural history is probably more important in this case than most, because the complaint is couched in the nature of the process in vain. And that's in fact the way we defended that case in front of the board and the parent. When this case arose, my client represented a gentleman who had had an arrearage in the child support enforcement agency. He initiated an action because he had not had visitation with the child. Eventually, service was obtained on his ex-wife, and he learned during that process that his wife had adopted his child, and he no longer had parental rights. Then, in resolving the amounts of money that were owed or either one of the parties, it was determined that the amount of money was owed to his first ex-wife. The ex-wife elected not to seek a monetary judgment. This was in the nature of contempt in the domestic relations court. So that's where we get to the proposition of was this or was this not a fraudulent conveyance. It was never an action for money, it was for behavior. The ex-wife was attempting to hold husband in contempt. We obviously then get to the point of the interrogatories when they were answered and how they were answered and how this gentleman was counseled by my client. His deposition was taken during this process by Mr. Bold's deposition. It was clear that he had remarried, and his current wife had indicated to him their marriage on the rocks. You're going to convey to me the interest in the real estate where we currently reside. He talked to Ms. Wallace, who was a relatively young lawyer, and she indicated to him that she thought the transaction might be voidable by a creditor. I think she was absolutely correct. The interrogatories that were sent to her, in this case by Ms. Nagler, were inartfully drafted. They did not ask, have you owned real estate previously? What have you owned real estate? Is do you currently own real estate? No question. Her client asked her to transfer the property to his real estate, then answer that question that I do not own real estate.
His interest was one half
undivided interest in that real estate. And this residence was a residence that this gentleman had lived in for the majority of his life. He made a bona fide purchase from another family member. He had resided there before. His prior wife knew that, raised all kinds of other issues on notice as to prior objection. But our argument here is the panel did in fact find that this was not a fraudulent conveyance. But then they determined that my client had engaged in other conduct which was unprofessional and disreputed upon the profession.
Do you think that we can't tell what the panel was thinking or what the board was thinking or what their reason is? They cite, of course, the rule, the catch-all rule, but do you think it's because the board believed that the lawyer here should have gone beyond the technical words of the interrogatory, for example, and advised?
I think that it was something like that, that lawyers presented and this court sent a message all the time with some pressures from their clients. Sometimes you just have to resist, say no, be more careful, follow through better. I think they might have been thinking that, and I would love to have the opportunity to address that. But under the governance of our rules, I don't think there's any question that a lawyer and his counsel need be given and have the right for procedural due process reasons to be put on notice as the specific conduct that they're being charged with. And you have the conflicting catch-all rule. But I think under the normal rules of statutory construction, particularly the use of generis, that lawyer, the specific controls the generis.
We have a specific rule requiring relator to put respondent on notice as a specific conduct that they're defending against. Relator cited Buffalo, and we cited it also because we think it's a much more favorable case for respondent in this case. In the Buffalo case, similar situation developed, and in that particular case, after 3 days of hearing in front of the panel, and a continuance of over a month in order to address new issues that were raised, that was eventually by federal courts deemed not to be sufficient notice and a violation of procedural due process. In my brief, I cited you a quote from Judge Edwards from the Sixth Circuit, and Judge Edwards said that this does not even nominally approach normal, civil, or criminal due process to be given this type of notice when you're being supposedly being charged with specific violations. Our concerns are strictly that. When you realize that the burden of the relator is clear and convincing evidence, and the question, Mr. Chief Justice, which you raised, addresses specifically what conduct, why, what were they thinking? I think that the rules, the government of bar rules, are presented with a reason. I think they have meaning. In the collateral cases which this court has cited on general categories of crimes, like say disorderly conduct or reckless driving, it's not anything that you think is disorderly. It's not any driving that you think is reckless. There are specific elements to those offenses, and those charged with a violation must prove the specific acts which they allege. No one can stand before this court and define what the other conduct is. We can guess and we can speculate. Our feeling is that the fraudulent conveyance aspect of this was litigated fully by way of discovery and before the panel, and relator just did not carry that burden. But it suggests to you that an Kuzma's bizarre opinion to read, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, but guilty of general misconduct, where the allegations are narrow and there is no violation, it has been hard to look your client in the eye and say you've been given fair notice, and this opinion speaks to other lawyers as to what the court does or does not permit. If I may, I'd like to reserve any time that I may have left, unless there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brewer.
Thank you.
Mr. Penny.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Justices, may please support Mr. John Penny on behalf of the Senate Bar. We, too, are somewhat uncomfortable with the manner in which the board chose to address the allegations of this complaint. And for that reason, we do the model objections. I say at the outset, as I said in our objection as filed, is that we think that there are mitigating circumstances and have no objection or concern with the penalty of public reprimand. So we think that the board, as we're trying to read their mind, trying to approach this matter through the back door in a sense, because the nature of the offenses charged, the disciplinary rules at issue here are ones that ordinarily, absent particularly significant mitigating circumstances, do not warrant a public reprimand type of penalty. And so, I think we still need to get back to what function or purpose the catch-all provision under DR 102.86 provides. It should be written out in other rules entirely by this court or not. We believe that the court here did limit itself to consideration of the specific acts of alleged misconduct that were asserted in the original complaint, and which formed the basis of the evidentiary hearing that was conducted before the panel and the board. And based solely upon that, they concluded that this was sufficient conduct that brought disrepute on the profession to warrant indeed, and I'll touch upon that in a moment. The other is also, perhaps even in my mind, more serious under the circumstances in this case, and that is a intentional fraudulent concealment of fact as material to the matters in litigation. And that specifically was the misleading answer of interrogatories that said clearly and unequivocally none with regard to the ownership of real estate. And why is that significant? I submit because lawyers get discovery requests all the time, and there inevitably is a time period between which the requests are received and the answers are given. The most apropos analogy that I see in this situation is where, for example, a lawyer receives a document request. It's received on the first day of, say, July, and the answers are due on the 28th or 29th of July. In the interim, the documents have been destroyed because the party, the client, doesn't wish to produce those documents. Well, is an honest, non-concealing answer at the end, we have no documents. There are no documents. This is exactly an analogous situation, we think, with regard to a request made as of the end of May of 1985, that do you own any real estate?
I guess the right way, or a better way to phrase the interrogatory would have been, on X date did you own real estate? Or that would have caught the, that would have been the question that would have caught the fact. That,
sure, one can think of all kinds of different ways. Mr. Liu points out that the interrogatories could have been drafted differently. But the question is, what is the substance? What is the clear, unquestioned intent of what the interrogatory spoke to? And what was the answer? And was it a true and honest answer based upon the facts that had occurred? And I think the fraudulent concealment cases are exactly on all fours in dealing with the kind of response that both is required by law and which this court ought to expect of attorneys licensed by the state of Ohio to practice before the courts of this state.
Who's responsible for the answers?
Well, in this particular case, there was a court.
No, just in general.
In general?
Who was the question directed to?
Certainly the client.
All right. Now, are you saying that the attorney has to know whether or not the client is lying and ascertain that the answer the client is giving is a lie?
No, sir. But
in this case, did the attorney know that, did the attorney make up the answer or did
yes,
the client?
Well, the way the facts unfolded is that in late May, the client asked whether the former wife would put a lien on this property, and the attorney said yes.
Is the attorney responsible for investigating the answers that he gets from his client to make sure they're truthful?
Well, I would say to a degree, to take reasonable steps to make certain that the answers are correct. That's not an issue here.
I'm talking about the responsibility of the attorney in answering this type of inquiry. Most of it, you direct it to your clients, said answer these, we have to get these back in, answer these questions, and they send them back in, and the attorney doesn't know whether the client's lying or not. Correct?
That's true. I suppose that's true, but if the client has good reason to believe that the answers are either false or are concealing,
if the client, if the client has reason to believe?
No, the lawyer has reason to believe that the answer provided by the client is fraudulent or is knowingly concealing a fact.
And in this case, you say that there was clear evidence that the lawyer knew the answers to the interrogatories were false.
Well, we're getting into a word game, Justice Sweeney.
No, we're getting into justice. I want to try and find out when an attorney is responsible and can be charged with a disciplinary act of falsity of answers by his client, unknowing that the answers are false. That's what I'm trying to find out.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
All right.
The facts here, and I think I need to go through them in just a little bit of detail if I could, is that the client asked whether the property could be transferred. There was a deed in May 31st signed, recorded June 7th, transferring this property.
The deed was prepared by the lawyer, wasn't it?
That's right.
Isn't that the important point you want to make, is that sure the lawyer knew, because the lawyer prepared the deed?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that on the 1st of July, the client had submitted proposed answers, leaving interrogatory number 8, the critical interrogatory, blank. In a telephone conversation, and this is part of the stipulations, the lawyer asked the client, do you honestly believe that you currently own any interest in that real estate? And the client said, no. And the lawyer then filled in the answer, none, and then submitted those answers to the opposing side. So in this particular case, the lawyer knew all of the material facts and participated in the dissemination of the fraudulent or concealed response. Just in the few moments that I have left, with regard to the burden of proof, which was really the focus of the board's finding with regard to the specific disciplinary rules alleged, is that the court found that there was a lack of proof with regard to fraudulent conveyance. Well, the relator was primarily relying upon the respondent's own admissions, both in the stipulations and also in the written correspondence that were authored by the respondent herself. And there are two key letters, both of which are appended to the brief filed by the relator here. The first was a March 13th letter, which was marked below as Exhibit 7 under Tab 6 of our brief. And it was a letter to her client basically saying, what have you done to me? I'm very upset with you. I'm not going to represent you anymore. But she included a statement in that which said, as I previously advised you prior to drafting said deed, the transfer of the real estate to your wife can be voided as a fraudulent conveyance. And further, in her specific response to the relator's complaint that was presented to her, that's part of Exhibit F of stipulations, which is under Tab 5 here, she responded to the investigating attorney. I further explained to Mr. Boland that the transfer could be void, and therefore he would be wasting money and potentially damaging this case. We relied primarily upon that evidence that the respondent admitted knowing at the time that this was a fraudulent conveyance. There was some conflicting evidence that the respondent gave during the course of the hearing. The court wishes to look at the transcript. But primarily, the focus is that she admitted that she was mindful and aware that this was a fraudulent conveyance, and therefore the disciplinary rules invoke for having participated in a fraudulent conveyance. So the two key counts is one, participating in connection with the execution of the deed, which constituted a fraudulent conveyance. There are also other badges of fraud that are listed in the statute. Almost each one of them would have been triggered with an affirmative response. And then secondly, as I've responded primarily to Justice Sweeney's questions, the interrogatories were sufficiently fraudulent to ask for the related facts and his burden. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Penny. Mr. Berger, you've saved 7 minutes of your time.
Now, I think there are a couple of things that are critical in this case. Number one, my client was just confronted by the bar and the investigators. The other lawyers said, what did I do with fraudulent conveyance? And they acknowledged this in their own whole procedure. She backed out, got out of the case, didn't proceed any further. You know, her wording, I think you take more than. Secondly, this court has told us on May time, recording real estate, which this was done timely, is notice to the world. This transaction was recorded within a week of it taking place. So the fact that it was being concealed is not true. And as much as we would talk about, this was obviously a fraudulent conveyance, that dog would not hunt in front of the panel. And the same report was called as a witness. My client was called as a witness. It was a lengthy hearing, and there was reliance on oral statement under examination and cross-examination by both parties. Yes?
Did the ex-wife ever live in this property when she was married?
No, she did not. First Miss Baldwin did not live in that house.
Did Mr. Baldwin actually sell it to his current wife? Because they talk about a sale of property. Did the second wife then sell it after the wedding?
I don't think technically he sold it. I mean, the wife thought that she was entitled to it, the second.
And it says a portion of the proceeds from the sale was used by Mr. Baldwin to support judgment.
What happened, Your Honor, was when this amount, some certain, was due in the domestic relations court, Mr. Baldwin had some money, and some of the sale proceeds from the sale of real estate was used to...
But the sale might prove, but then did his wife, or did she sell it to
No, it was a result of a sold subsequently. The wife competed to another member of the family for value. The proceeds from that sale plus other money produced to satisfy the obligation in domestic relations.
And the findings also state that he did pay the judgment in full.
He did.
Did the wife have to go through some money in action, or was this just...
No. That he paid that very close to the time that they agreed on. There's like an agreement to pay, and this is depending, correct me if I'm wrong, in January, and through closing the property wasn't paid until like March. It's a matter of a couple of extra months. There was no, but it was paid in full. I don't think there was any question that he kindly paid these amounts. The other part, though, which is really troubling on these interrogatories, when we say, what did we think? When I'm hired by a client, and the opposing counsel prepares interrogatories, and they're bad interrogatories, do I say, well, I think that they really mean that you should disclose things that were clearly not asked for? That was the problem in this case. It was an inartfully drafted interrogatory. Then the question to all practicing lawyers is, why do we have two lawyers? Why don't we just have one lawyer represent both parties and say, well, I know what you mean, I know what you mean, let's all get together, and there's nothing adversary? It's a troubling question, and I don't know where to draw the line, but this case really presents that type of dilemma. And I would submit that this was fully litigated in front of the panel. These exact arguments were made, and that panel did not think that we later carried this case. They had all the people there to ask questions of to make it. They did not have to rely on any letters. The other issue, which I think I cannot emphasize enough, even in the comments that the later counsel made to this court, Ms. Wallace, when confronted with this, walked away and cooperated fully with Relator, gave him a full file, did exactly what she was requested to do, cut out the litigation, accepted no money. And the idea that in those circumstances, it's like every client's idea, comes to my office, I know my rights. No, you don't. And it's like a young lawyer, I did a fraudulent conveyance, accept it. But under the facts of the law and in terms of the board's part, which we are bound by, this was not a fraudulent conveyance. And again, I would emphasize that the underlying proceeding was for contempt. And contempt is punishable by behavior, by the court. It was not. The first Ms. Bolin was asked if she was going for a money judgment, a lump sum judgment. And they said, no, they did not elect in the domestic relations court to ask for a lump sum judgment. They wanted a finding of contempt. Making that election takes you out of the debtor-creditor aspect which fraudulent conveyances are directed towards, and which is a purview of being in contempt of the board's court. That is not the proper sphere for fraudulent conveyances. Thank you.
Thank you. For those cases submitted, you'll be advised of our opinion.